sometimes in counseling sessions, I will tell somebody that I've seldom learned anything of any real value on vacation. That most everything of substance that I have learned in my life has come from trial and pain and error. But I would add to this morning that the most value, perhaps, out of all the trials and errors I've been through, the most value came when I was where I didn't want to be, doing what I didn't want to do with someone I would rather have avoided. Repentant hearts are often directed by God to face their past in their present in order to clear the path for their future. If we won't go where we don't want to go, then we cannot be where we need to be for our own good and for the glory of God. Last week I said that we are indeed a society that seeks to be pain-free. We talked about pain-free dentistry. But I think that also includes, maybe even much more so, the pain that people bring to the table. I think having to deal with people is one of the most difficult things we all have to deal with. In Ruth chapter 1, verse 6, when we were there, the news of God's work in Judea came to the ears of Naomi, and that was good news. The famine was over. The harvest was again growing and ready in Israel. However, going back home would not be a joyous reunion of family and friends. For her, it would be going home less in every way than she left. She's returning, at least by human standards, certainly not God's, but as a failure, not a success, with a seeming curse and not God's blessing, facing those that she knew well and knew her well as a shell of the woman that actually left perhaps even two decades before. But because of her past, her present will become a part of the future, really, of the entire world. And our knowledge of that truth, our knowledge of the plan of God, is not a requirement for that to happen. We don't have to have any knowledge of what God is doing when he moves us to go or do what we really would rather not do. Our part isn't to question what God is doing or to say, I'm happy to go if you'll tell me why it is I'm going. But it's to go where he sends us and to do what he would have us to do, period. And he knows how to make that very thing very clear to us in his kind providence. When word came of God's work in Judea, Naomi knew where she needed to go. There was no question. And her repentant heart towards God directed what she would have to do on arrival, which was in the least face all of those people who knew her so well. So let's go to Ruth. We're going to be finishing out chapter 1 today. We're going to read verses 19 through 22. Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah have had the discussion about the daughter-in-law's staying with her. Orpah has gone back to be with her family. Ruth, on the other hand, has made a faith commitment to go with Naomi as a Moabitess back to Bethlehem, Judah. She's made a commitment not just to Naomi, but to Naomi's people and to Naomi's God. And when Naomi was clearly not going to change her mind about that, they ceased to debate this issue and began that journey. We pick up in verse 19. So they two went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them and said, is this Naomi? And she said unto them, call me not Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why then call you me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. Now, we don't have much info, really, about Naomi of Bethlehem, Judah, pre-famine. Not a lot. When we started the book of Ruth, we noted that her husband, Elimelech, was an Ephrathite, which meant he was a founding, his family, at least, was a founding member of the city of Bethlehem, Judah. She was a woman of some standing. Everybody in the city knew her, and she was a woman of some wealth, at least to some degree. May not have been the most wealthy woman in the city, but perhaps. I think it's also safe to assume that she had a good reputation in that city. Her name, which means pleasant, seems to have typified her. I think that the evidence of that certainly is in the devotion of both of her daughter-in-laws, that they wanted to stay with her. They were utterly devoted to her. And I think the reaction of the city also confirms that when they see her, because I think they see an extreme contrast to that pleasant woman that they knew. I'm not saying she was unpleasant, but perhaps that congenial look that she wore in the city prior to this that made her that pleasant woman was no longer apparent. We note it says that all the city was moved. The ESV says the whole city was stirred. The Hebrew word is hum, and it refers to a noisy uproar. And so what you've got is that if everybody in this room was talking about one thing at the same time, but almost out loud, but not quite out loud, you'd hear that murmuring going on, and that's what was going on. Everybody was talking about Naomi's return to the city. They saw the change in her countenance. They saw the change in her status. And now she returns not only looking what she's been through, all of the stress and the strain of losing two sons and a husband, running out of goods, but she returns with a Moabitess, certainly not the most attractive person as far as people go to be bringing back with you. They were not well loved in Israel. We note that everyone is saying, is this Naomi? I've run into a few guys I graduated from high school with and said, is that Bob? You know? And everybody's looking at her and saying, is that Naomi? Because nobody can believe the difference in her and in her status. But we also note how Naomi responds to the city. And I don't think she got up on a box somewhere and preached to everyone. But as people approached her, as crowds gathered around her, and she began to respond to their questions or maybe just their stares, who knows. What we don't see here is a woe is me story to lighten her load. She doesn't begin to unload saying, well, we want the best of intentions. Who knew my sons were going to die? Who knew my husband was going to die? Who knew all these things were going to happen to me? We don't find that in her response at all. She is seeking no pity. She is deferring no blame. She doesn't say, well, you know, that's my husband's call. I didn't really want to go, but he wanted to go. We don't even know whether she was in favor of leaving in the first place. She might have been just as excited about going to Moab and the famine as he was. Who knows? She doesn't defer any blame. She calls in no favors. She doesn't look across the room and say, yeah, you know what I did for you when I was here? You know what I did for you when I was here? And she's not looking out there and saying, listen, you all owe me in some way. She does not employ the natural tendency towards self-protection. I mean, she's just traveled 1,800 miles, and during that time, you can't tell me that she couldn't have concocted a story to tell, a safety net to erect when she got home. Now, I'm not saying that that didn't cross her mind. I think that all the way back, perhaps, she was thinking about how she was going to respond. Every single time I've had to face a troubling situation with people, where I knew a meeting was coming up or something was going to happen, where I had to be face to face, it's my mind's natural tendency to start having that conversation in advance. Does anybody here do that? You all do that, don't you? We're having that whole conversation. In fact, usually I'm up all night arguing my point. And did you ever notice that when you actually get to that confrontation, nothing that you thought of ever actually happens? Nothing. It goes a completely different way. So whatever crossed her mind for that 1,800 miles, she didn't use any sort of a self-protective method. She didn't concoct any sort of story that would have lightened that load for her. In fact, what she does is she places responsibility directly on herself. Now, several commentaries I have, in fact, most of the commentaries I have, believe that she was bitter about what God did. She doesn't say she's bitter in this text. She said God acted bitterly towards her. That's what she said. He has dealt very bitterly with me. She doesn't say I'm very bitter towards him any place in here. There's nothing in this scenario that we've been reading through that reflects anything but repentance, as far as I'm concerned. She refers to God in true and respectful terms. She says he is the Almighty. He's El Shaddai, the self-sufficient, omnipotent one. The Almighty is a name that expresses God's uncontestable power to do as he pleases with all of his creation. That's who the Almighty is. He is the Lord to her. Jehovah or Yahweh is the name that God chose to relate to his covenant people. It reflects his eternality in connection to keeping his word. It's a covenantal name in every essence. He is utterly faithful forever, even when we do not remain faithful to him. And it is the covenant God, it is Jehovah God, who has brought her home again. And it is he who testifies that she left her covenant land. At least he's testifying that to her. I don't know that it says there's no prophets that have come to say those words. I'm sure she is speaking from her own heart based upon everything she's experienced. It's the Almighty in her mind and heart that has broken her into pieces. God is justified, and Naomi casts no blame of injustice upon him. She's not saying, I just followed my husband, and the Lord has been bitter against me, and I'm not happy. She comes home, and she owns where she is at in her life right then. She is transparent and dependent upon whatever he is going to do. She doesn't say, I don't know where this is coming from. She doesn't sidestep the Lord in this at all. She says, everything is coming down because God is testifying against me. And if God is testifying, if Jehovah, if covenant God is testifying against me, I've got this coming. Let me tell you something here. Ruth didn't commit to the God that Naomi was bitter against. Ruth doesn't come over here in 16 and said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after you, for where you go, I'll go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Now listen, I'm Ruth, and I'm your daughter-in-law, and I want to go where you go, and I want to be bitter against the same God you're bitter against. That's the person she wants to follow? Does that make any sense to you at all? Ruth wasn't following a bitter woman in despair. She was following a broken, repentant, and faithful woman going home to the Lord. That woman that she knew, that woman who taught her, at least evidently, much or some about who Jehovah God was the woman she wanted to follow back to Bethlehem. Do you want to go back with a crotchety old bitter woman back to some place that with people that are probably not going to treat you all that well? To a land that's not your land? As a Moabitess? This is what you want to do? Naomi is at the mercy of the Lord. And he leads and she follows. She is no longer the self-sufficient woman of any way she was before she left. She is no longer the woman of stature that she once was. And Bethlehem, Judah, is where she must be, and it must not be avoided. And it's significant, although we're not going to deal with it a lot here, we're going to deal with it, that she left in the famine and has returned at the beginning of the harvest. She's coming back to the harvest. In reality, I don't think she's yet to see. In fact, I'm certain that she's yet to see that. In reality, I think when her husband and her sons and they packed up and made that trek to Moab, that they left while they still had a significant amount of stuff. And I think when she says, "I left full and came back empty," she hasn't really realized yet that in reality she left empty and she's returned full. Everything of real value is only found in the Lord. It's not found in any of our self-sufficiency. No matter how much she had when she left, if she was not in utter dependence upon the Lord in every way, then she left empty. But now, in a repentant heart, she's really returning full to the harvest. Turn to Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 through 21. Matthew 6, verses 19 to 21 says, "Lay not up for yourself treasures upon the earth, where moth and rust does corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourself treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust does corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." If our treasure is the Lord, then our heart will go wherever he leads us. Naomi is now full of treasure. She doesn't understand all that yet. She doesn't see the benefit of all of what God is going to do yet. She has no understanding of any of that at all. And yet that truth is still there. Listen, doing what she's doing might not be what we would choose to do, but it is certainly what we would need to do, and it's what she needs to do as well. In the book of Exodus, chapter 3, turn to Exodus 3. I think we're going to actually read in starting in verse 11, but Exodus 3, we're going to jump around a little bit there in Exodus. I'm going to make a point rather than read a whole section of text. But in Exodus 3, the Lord would send Moses back to the Egypt that he had fled 40 years earlier. He's now 80 years old. He's been living in the desert as a shepherd for all those years. He fled Egypt when he murdered an Egyptian in order to defend the Hebrews. He was abusing the Hebrew people, and Moses reacted. There was a scuffle. The Egyptian died, and Moses ran. He's been hiding in the wilderness ever since. But the calling of God to return to the land of Egypt was not what Moses wanted. Now understand that that calling came out of a burning bush. If you are standing before a talking burning bush, it seems like you would just say, "Whatever, I'll do whatever you want me to do." It's a talking burning bush. That's not what Moses did. Listen to Exodus 3:11. We're just going to hit on Moses' response. The Lord is telling him he's going back. That's the basis of this conversation. No, Moses said, verse 11, Moses said unto God, "Who am I that I should go unto Pharaoh and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" Now, you might say, well, he's being humble there, but in reality, he don't want to go. When he says, "Who am I?" he's saying, "I'm nothing," but he's also saying, "I really don't want to go back there." Verse 13, Moses said unto God, Behold, when I come into the children of Israel, and shall say unto them, The God of your fathers has sent me unto you, and they shall say unto me, What is his name? What shall I say unto them? And verse 14, God says unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me unto you. And we're going to see that there's the reality of the reaction of Moses. Sounds like he's just worried about going back because he's not worthy and he doesn't know what he's going to say. But these responses back to God are building. Let's go to chapter 4, verse 1. And Moses answered and said, But behold, they will not believe me, nor hearken unto my voice, for they will say, The Lord has not appeared unto you. That's his response. It's still building, isn't it? Verse 10. And Moses said unto the Lord, Oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent. Neither heretofore nor since thou hast spoken unto thy servant, but I am slow of speech and of a slow tongue. He had a bit of a stutter. Slow tongue. Not an eloquent man. Verse 13. And he said, O my Lord, send, I pray thee, by the hand of him whom thou wilt send. Because the Lord says, listen, Moses said, what about Aaron? Aaron's a good speaker. Why don't you send Aaron? And he says, well, Aaron's going to talk to you, but you're going to say the words. I'm sending you. He's tried every way to kind of defer this whole thing. And then in verse 14. So we know that this is not just the Moses saying, listen, I'm really not worthy. I'm not an eloquent man. But these are all him trying not to go. It says, and the anger of the Lord in verse 14 was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. You're telling me something? And also, behold, he comes forth to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you will speak, verse 15, unto him and put words in his mouth. And I will be with your mouth and with his mouth and will teach you what you shall do. This is the anger of the Lord was kindled against him because he kept making excuses. You can couch those in any kind of false humility that you want and say, well, I'm not that guy. And all you're doing is trying to find a way to defer what God is trying to send you to do because you don't want to go back. Now, let's be fair to Moses. You came out of the household of Pharaoh. You were raised there as a Hebrew child in the household of Pharaoh. And out of that household, you have killed an Egyptian and fled. Do you want to go back? I wouldn't want to go back. I'm not going to tell you for a moment that I wouldn't have said the exact same things that he is saying. Why, we would like to think that if we were talking to a burning bush, that whatever the bush said, we'd say okay and just do that. But in reality, we're all really pretty much the same. When we don't want to do something, we try to find ways to get around it. And that's what he was doing. But the truth is, Moses was the one that had to go back in order to leave with his people. It wasn't enough that he defended them over a scuffle, but he was there to take them out. And he was going to do so with Pharaoh's submission, and he was going to do so with Pharaoh's goods. There was no place else Moses should have been but in Egypt, no matter what he said. Jacob, we're not going to turn to some of these, but we're going to kind of bounce through them a little bit here. But Jacob, what did Jacob do? Jacob, talk about a hairy brother, in order to make his mostly blind father think that he was... My phone is responding to this. I've got it off. Evidently, this thinks it's a better preacher than I am, and it may be so. That's crazy. Jacob's not here. Jacob can't take your call right now. Never had that happen before. But Jacob, in order to deceive his mostly blind father and to cause his father to think that he was Esau, actually took the fur from a sheep and put it on his arm. So when his father felt his arm, he says, oh, that's Esau. Nobody else feels like a sheep. But he deceives his father Isaac to receive the blessing that belonged to Esau, and then he tricks his brother Esau, which evidently wasn't hard because Esau agreed to it over a bowl of red soup out of his birthright. And Esau, when he discovered both the deception of his father and himself, threatened to kill Jacob, and Jacob fled into Padan Aram for 20 years, where he married both Leah and Rachel, not intentionally, but out of deceit. He deceived. When he got there, his uncle, Laban, deceived him. So he's gone for 20 years. And guess what? The Lord brings Jacob back to restore the broken relationship with his brother. Even with all the apparent possibilities of a war breaking out between the two. In fact, when Jacob gets to the border, he takes and divides his whole entire family and flocks and everything else into two groups. Just so, if Esau comes to kill him, while they're killing this group can get away. Or if they're killing this one can flee. So he can at least save half his family. And when he receives word that Esau's on his way, that word has arrived from Jacob to Esau, that Jacob is there, Esau's coming with 400 guys. I'm happy to see you, brother. And brought everybody with me, all of my men of war. Doesn't look good, does it? But that's where the Lord sent Jacob back to. And Jacob had to go with his hat in his hand. Now the brothers did, in short, mend fences, even though the restoration was not in full. In fact, the Edomites, who are the descendants of Esau, hated Israel all the rest of their days until there were no more Edomites left on the earth, for the Lord removed them from the earth. But the brothers were at least, and we still don't know whether Esau was trying to deceive his brother because he said, hey, listen, why don't I put some of my men with your men and help you out a little bit, and why don't you follow me into this part of the country and so forth, and Jacob was very gracious and said, no, it's not necessary. I've got it under control. And Jacob took all of his people after this and went another direction. So they still didn't trust each other. But they were able, when Isaac finally died at 180 years old, to come back together to bury their father. The Lord made Jacob go back. He would not allow this chosen man to avoid his brother. No excuses needed, but forgiveness was needed. And Esau's response was not Jacob's business. It really didn't matter on the way back whether Esau was coming to wipe Jacob out or not. He could prepare for the worst. The Lord didn't say, listen, go back and see your brother and don't worry about it. I got your back. Nothing's going to happen to you. He didn't soften the blow in advance and say, don't worry about that army coming. I've got you covered. He just said, go back and do what I tell you to do. But Jacob's facing the unknown of what might happen when he gets there. Job had to bear up under the accusations of his friends. His reputation and his character were damaged without just cause. But he didn't flee. Had he, it's been happening nowadays, he would have filed suit. But he didn't file suit. He stayed and endured and waited in pain. His children are dead. His flocks are gone. His houses are down. He's got boils all over his body. His wife's telling him to curse God and die. And his friends are saying, what in the world did you do to cause all of this? He's saying, you're the reason your kids are dead. You're the reason you lost everything. You're the reason your wife is telling you to curse God. You're the reason. And Job's saying, I don't see anything. I don't know what I did. I'm not saying I'm a perfect man, but he's saying, listen, I've checked and I don't see anything in my life that I did that would rise to the level of God doing this. And so he sits there and he takes this beating. But that's where he had to stay, in the cauldron, right there in the heat, waiting to see what would happen. And it was God himself that brought vindication. And guess what happened when God vindicated Job? Job wanted to respond by saying, "See?" And the Lord said, "You shut up. You just be quiet. That's right, I'm vindicating you in that sense, but you're not going to gloat over all your friends about your innocence." Because in reality, none of us are really innocent, are we? David had to fast and sit and watch his son die. And the result of that illicit relationship with Bathsheba and the death of Uriah the Hittite, this child was born and God took him. They said David fasted and prayed and refused to be comforted. And the whole entire time that child was dying until the child died. And then it says that he cleaned up and ate and thanked the Lord. There was a price to pay for his sin with Bathsheba. And it couldn't be paid at a distance. He couldn't say, "I can't bear to watch this happen to my son, so I'm going to go away for a while. And I'm a king. I can insulate myself from anybody I want to. I can have 30 concubines standing around in a circle feeding me grapes all day, and I don't have to watch this." He went right there, and he stood right by the side of that child, and he prayed and he fasted to see what God would do. But he had to be right there. He couldn't leave and simply wait for word to arrive of what happened. He had to face every agonizing minute to the very end. The Lord Jesus sweat great drops of blood in Gethsemane. Hematidrosis, I think they call that. It's an anxiety that causes blood to mix with sweat. Listen, the road ahead for him was full of torture and death. That's what lay ahead when he was in Gethsemane praying. But it was the only road the Father had set before him. The only road to finish the work that he came here to do. John 12, verse 27, Jesus says, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour? But for this cause came I unto this hour." For this cause. Matthew 16, 25, he says, "Whosoever will save his life will lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it." And he had to walk that road to lose his life so that we could have life. The apostles, when Jesus was hanging on that cross, save the apostle John, hid in a locked room while Jesus suffered and died. For 3 days they were in that locked room in fear of losing their lives until Jesus came to them through that locked door and confronted them right there. "Look, it's me. Go ahead and touch me. See that I'm real." Later, before his ascension, Jesus would give Peter, who had hidden, a glimpse of his own future. Turn to John 21, verse 18. John 21, 18. Not what you want to hear. Well, I say, "I wish the Lord would be more clear about what he's doing with my life." We want him to do that as long as he's saying, "Don't worry, there's great comfort and joy coming your way." Or, "Don't worry, they're going to kill you." That's not what we want to hear, right? John 21, 18. "Verily, verily," he says unto Peter, "I say unto you, when you were young, you girded yourself and you walked where you wanted to walk," basically where you would. "But when you shall be old, you shall stretch forth your hands and another will gird you and carry you whither thou wouldst not." They're going to take you where you would rather not go. But he did go. He wasn't leaping with joy on the way there. That's not the point, is it? The point isn't that we, if we're in faith, we don't feel any anxiety. The point isn't if we're in faith, we just run to our own execution. Absolutely not. It's not about that. When we talk about soldiers in combat and we say that man was very brave, I'm here to tell you that man was scared out of his wits, but he did it anyway. It's not the absence of fear. Courage isn't the absence of fear. It's acting in spite of it. The Lord would make Peter ready to go where he would rather not go. And all the apostles but John, who was the only one who didn't hide with the rest, they all died a martyr's death. Now, truth of the matter is, none of us are likely to be called to a martyr's end. It's not likely. Our choices will be far less than any of the examples I used here, less than Jacob's and less than Peter's future and less than Moses going back to Egypt. But it's not about the severity of the situation we're going to face or how drastic the consequences might be when we get there. It's about the willingness to simply go where he sends us and do as he determines. And let me tell you something. If we won't do what's less, we'll never do what's more. Might it be hard to face your family, a family situation, knowing that your family might turn their back on you? Yes. Is that going to be painful? Yes. Is that the same thing as having 400 guys coming at you in the distance? No. Is it the same as going back and facing Pharaoh and saying to the people, about the people that he technically owns, the Hebrews, and saying, let my people go? None of us are going to be asked to do that. I don't know what people we would do that for. I'd have to go back to Ireland or Scotland and do that, I suppose. I don't know. But the most value comes when we're where we don't want to be, doing what we don't want to do with someone we would rather avoid. It's not really about how severe that is. It's about the willingness to go and to do, no matter what. It's much easier to avoid it. I've had situations here over the last 40 years where we've had a falling out with a family or something here that was particularly grievous, and I was always amazed that over the course of months and months, living in the same community, I would never see them. I wouldn't see them any place I went. I went to all the same places I always went. I'd never see them. And then that one day, you'd just be forgetting all about it now. And you actually think that you're kind of past all of that because it's been so long you haven't even thought about it anymore. And you're walking into Kohl's and the door is open and there they are. And what are you going to do? You're going to turn your head and walk around and avoid them? You're going to turn your back and go back to your car? How are you going to approach that? Because the Lord's opened that door too, that automatic door, but still he opened it. And he means for you to face that with grace and kindness. And that's what he means. We don't even have to seek those things out. We just need to be ready for it when they come. We don't have to be running around looking to run into them or anything else. We just need to be willing when God brings it together. Because we cannot get what God intends for us to have if we won't go where he intends to give it to us. You know that when churches have splits, that if we were to sit down and you were to say, let's say 20 of you left because we were having problems here. Wow, is it going to be empty in here? Let's say 20 of you left. There's probably really only 3 or 4 of you that are actually involved in the issue that pertains to the split. The rest of you just don't want to be where there are issues. But the Lord means for you to learn something in the midst of that, not to find some place to go to get away from that. The things I know today are from staying put, not running. And I'm here to tell you, and Carol Jean will tell you, I've wanted to run a lot of times. A lot. Naomi was called back. The Lord opened the door. Word came all the way out in the middle of some place, who knows, Moab, and said, the Lord's growing food in Bethlehem, Judah again. She knew she had to go home. All that way, she was willing to go by herself, but the Lord gave her a companion who would become a part of the genealogy of Jesus. Do you think Naomi sees that? No. Not even a little bit. But she has to go back for that to happen. You have no idea what God is doing with what he's doing in your life, and neither do I. That's beyond our pay grade. Our job is to obey him and to do it with kindness and grace. And to have fear, okay, but not to let fear ruin and run our lives. Trust him. Move forward. Go. Do. Don't avoid. Amen? Let's bow our heads. We'll have prayer. Get ready for the final hymn and the benediction. Heavenly Father, Lord.